Good evening. Good evening and welcome to the inaugural lecture by Paul Gilroy, but just as significantly, it commemorates the beginning of a permanent chair at the school, the Anthony Giddens Professorship in Social Theory. And Professor Lord Giddens is here somewhere. Where is he? Where's he gone? There you are. Stand up. Tony, stand up. It's good to see you back in the school and you haven't been reshuffled by the government yet. The chair was set up and supported by a group of alumni, one or two of whom are here this evening, and we're delighted to see them. And it was set up as a chair in social theory, obviously to continue the Tony Giddens tradition. Well, sort of the Tony Giddens tradition. You're not required, however, to be a sort of Giddensian or whatever one might say. But we were thrilled when we were able to make, as the first appointment to this chair, to bring Paul Gilroy back from the US. Most recently, he was the Charlotte Marion Seddon Professor of Sociology and African American Studies at Yale and was chair of the Department of African American Studies there. And so we were thrilled to be able to bring back to the UK someone who had been for a while lost to the British academic scene. However, Paul is not an American, as you will quickly discover. Took his PhD in Birmingham, worked for the GLC and a number of universities in this country, became a professor at Goldsmiths before going and spending several years in Yale. He's the author of a number of books on nationalism and ethnicity, including There Ain't No Black in the Union Jack in 1987, The Black Atlantic, and his latest book was After Empire, Melancholia or Convivial Culture. And this evening, he is going to talk about multiculture in times of war, and I'm delighted to welcome to the school, and particularly this evening, Paul Gilroy. Thank you.
Good evening. It's a great honour for me to have the chance to address you under these circumstances, and I'm greatly appreciative of having the chance to come back here and to undertake work in this distinguished institution. On these occasions, it's easy to imperil the affirmative mood by talking about racism, and I am committed to that vulgar choice, which is often seen as a departure from proper scholarly standards. However, rather than sounding defensive in anticipation of the accusations of political correctness and relativism and so on that follow from that decision, I thought I'd try this evening to proceed without apology and strive instead to show why a focus on elements of racial hierarchy might not only be legitimate, but also productive in several key areas opened up by recent developments. On one side, by the much vaunted death of multiculturalism at the hands of homegrown terrorists, and on the other, by the prosecution of an apparently interminable war in which information does not stand outside the military campaign, but is lodged inside it as an element in the conflict. The latter development poses a special challenge to the social sciences, where agnotology, the cultural production of ignorance, and agnopolitics, the relationship of ignorance to power, have seldom been considered systematically. I want to try and place a discussion of Britain's present circumstances in a historical setting, illuminated by early 20th century commentaries on war, peace, and cosmopolitan responsibility, and by mid-20th century speculations on race and racism, which have a bearing upon the continuing links between racism, nationalism, and imperialism in the age of extraordinary rendition. At the core of my argument lies the suggestion that for this country, developing a durable and habitable multiculture depends upon working through the legacies of departed empire. That outcome is currently frustrated by the social, cultural, and psychological blockage that I name post-colonial melancholia. In preparing this talk, I've also been mindful of the fact that we are close to the 25th anniversary of the riots in Brixton and elsewhere. And those events are, let me emphasize, almost entirely responsible for my being in the position to address you tonight. It was in the aftermath of those events that I became employable as a university teacher and acquired a hold on a professional ladder I had not expected to be able to climb. It's conventional on these occasions to thank one's old teachers, but I have done that before. So I thought I'd thank the rioters instead, not just for what they did indirectly for me, but also, I think, for what they've done for this city and, indeed, for this polity. Their wild process deepened and enriched British democracy, galvanizing it against manifestations of injustice in the workings of law, education, and social policy. Most of all, they helped, I think, to adjust this country to the presence of minority citizens whose difficult life experience could not, even then, be adequately contained under the heading immigration. And, you know, perhaps we need some more riots if we're going to ensure that the burden of educating black and minority ethnic Britons is not going to be entirely carried out by London Metropolitan University. So let's hope, let's hope that that happens. When I employ the concept of racism, I do not mean a thing called race. Let me emphasize, I'm not referring to some neat and tidy ideological package or functional mechanism. For me, race is a relationship, and racism a discourse with metaphysical capacities. They are endowed with properties that confound conventional approaches to the relationship between rationality and irrationality. Racial discourses work on and with the senses in distinctive ways. They generate particular relationships between words and icons and other visual cues. Pressing the body into service with mimetic repetitions, signs and elisions, performatives that actively produce infrahumanity rather than merely classifying it retrospectively. Racism is therefore a system that generates the groups we know as racist rather than a set of commentaries upon the natural differences that those actors come to embody. Studying the interplay of racialized law and racialized life from this perspective necessitates particular interpretive skills. It involves exercises in historical ontology that exhibit sensitivity to the sort of inquiry defined by Ian Hacking as a dynamic nominalism, in which the things that are named, objects among other objects, even if they are human beings, as Fanon might have put it, interact with the scientific and cultural, economic and governmental processes of their designation. In view of those complexities, it isn't enough, in my view, for sociology to quantify either personal attitudes or institutional processes which reproduce racial hierarchy and inequality. Both are necessary, but even together they are insufficient. Orthodox inquiries, of course, usually end with variations on those tired options. Racism's most militant expressions are reassigned so that they register only as legitimate outbursts of genuine fear, of anxiety about the pace of change, of insecurity and ebbing of respect. To say anything else, I think, is often to sacrifice a measure of scholastic credibility. However, the sociological and the political puzzles involved in explaining why quite so many unsavory social and historical processes are repeatedly registered through the political languages of race and ethnic absolutism pass unremarked on. Racism's effects are dismissed as insignificant until the next tragic death or inflammatory eruption make them newsworthy once again. And at that point, this thing called race gets discovered afresh with the utmost and the most sincere surprise. Expressions of racism will be approached with horror through a fog of novelty. And that tempo in which tragic and disturbing events punctuate quieter periods of apparent forgetting, which endure long enough only for the inevitable lament of "we didn't know" to appear plausible, is itself a significant part of the problems that interest me. Now, there were earlier rumbles in response to the publication of Bhikkhu Parekh's report, 2000, I think it was. But multiculturalism was first officially pronounced dead after September the 11th, 2001. Obituaries were cheerfully offered up after the arrest of the shoe bomber, Richard Reid, the mad French bomber, Zacharias Moussaoui, Omar Khan Sharif, the public school bomber, and Abdul El Faisal, the Jamaican-born imam, jailed under the 1861 Offences Against the Person Act for soliciting murder without a specific victim. The death notices were reissued with greater relish after the murderous and horrible events of last summer. And since then, they've been combined with an insistent governmental proposal that the country's investments in multiculturalism be redirected towards a wholesale re-evaluation of the tarnished notion of Britishness. This wholesome alternative would supposedly offer immediate benefits in the form of popular national feeling, akin to the civic patriotism sometimes evident in the United States. And these developments give practical expression to a tendentious political and theoretical assumption that solidarity and diversity cannot coexist. The detail of that argument is not worth reconstructing now, save to say that its sometimes complacent advocates have been disinclined to address the histories of white supremacism, of xenophobia, and of racial hatred that have been lapping at their ankles, if not at their knees. The assertion that greater diversity necessarily means diminished solidarity cannot survive 5 minutes' exposure to the social relations inside any institution of the National Health Service. Its proponents turn willfully and, in my view, deceitfully away from the exhilarating cultural interactions common in cities like this, which are not, or not yet anyway, segregated according to the principles of the racial nomos, which, as we saw in the aftermath of the New Orleans flood, is the silent and dominant partner of stubbornly color-coded U.S. political culture. Nonetheless, these ideas have started to circulate in governmental thinking. They've helped to precipitate an interesting change of national mood. One of the first experiences that brought home to me how much life had altered while I had been living abroad was my exposure to the deep yearning for restored greatness carved onto the faces of the large crowd thronging the Strand following the celebrations of last summer's cricketing triumph over Australia. As I wandered down from my unpacking the books in my office, it seemed in a way that marked a sort of sharp divergence from the Corinthian traditions that were drummed into me as a boy, as if the world was now being divided into a kind of Manichaean fashion into two large warring groups labeled winners and losers. The English are now supposed to be winners, and in sport and many other areas of life, this involves some tricky politico-theological operations. They demand that foreigners and floaters and freeloaders are excluded and that others are seen to lose. And that's, incidentally, why debates over citizenship of the England manager and the number of foreigners who play football in the Premier Division are so noteworthy. There's a kind of quiet struggle being conducted there over the Schmittian logic, which says, if you're not with us, you're against us. Many of the problems I want to explore now are connected to that thwarted desire for greatness, for the need for a place at the top table, for the pleasures of punching above our weight. And I interpret those desires and those phrases as after effects of imperial domination, of responses to the loss of imperial prestige. They are key components in the melancholic cultural formation which has shaped and, in my view, distorted the nation's social and cultural habits. We've recently begun to glimpse the first fruits of promoting St. George's Day as a solidarity-inducing festival. You'll have noticed the tone in which the Queen's recent birthday could be discussed has been altered to a more reverent one. And of course, I don't need to tell you that the memory of 1966 is being revived and infused with a sort of hefty neo-traditional significance as the tournament in Germany approaches. As part of that same shift, a heavily filtered and simplified projection of the plucky British struggle against Nazi Germany has been brought back into the center of our culture, our public culture. Why is that war celebrated as the very core of national identity by people too young to be touched by the living memory of it? Why do all of Britain's subsequent conflicts acquire irrefutable legitimacy if they can be presented as its analogues or extensions? Why has life in that wartime been molded to represent the last occasion in which authentic and undiluted monocultural Britons were absolutely certain as to who they were and what they stood for? If the Brits are to be united and robust, then, in the face of terror, in the face of Islam, in the face of unwanted immigration, in the face of European meddling, we must now become fundamentally and decisively the same. And war, particularly when it's associated with the comfort blanket of imagined monoculture, helps to secure that result. However, the national resurrection is hindered. Hindered by confusion and disorientation that arise continually from a situation in which melancholic and xenophobic Britain quietly concedes that it doesn't much like the aliens, the blacks, the foreigners, the Muslims, and other interlopers. It wants to be rid of them, but becomes uncomfortable, becomes tentative, because it doesn't like the things it learns about itself when it gives vent to those feelings of hostility. Once Britain was out there being great in the world it dominated. However, even a grudging recognition of that past can generate forms of hostility when, for example, the pain of loss is triggered by encounters with post-colonial settlers. Even if today's unwanted incomers from Brazil or from Eastern Europe are not actually post-colonial, they can still carry all the ambivalence of that vanished empire with them. And the recent situation in Barking showed it was not only the coloureds and the Muslims, but the ABCs, the Albanians, the Bosnians and the Kosovars, who introduced discomfort into the unhappy consciousness of their fearful and anxious hosts and neighbours. Indeed, the latest incomers might be unwanted and abused. Unwittingly stimulate the pain produced by memories of that vanished imperial past. The symptoms are intensified, of course, by the prospect of a sort of reverse colonization, either by the immigrants who dispossess you or by the gradual creeping Americanization and the geopolitical catastrophe to which it ties us. And that's how I would read, you know, these anxieties over child obesity, the fact that people, young people in this country, ring 911 instead of 999 when they want an ambulance. Even if they are white, these new denizens can be held hostage by the logic of race through the non-negotiable specification that they are immigrants. And here, immigration is always already war. The metaphor of alien settlement as invasion remains potent precisely because the post-1945 migrants were the intrusive, unwelcome post-colonial consequences of lost imperial prestige. Images of the wounded white working class, betrayed by its leaders who expected it to bear the brunt of cultural diversity, now beset by violent and criminal aliens, provides a means to assess the initial symbolic configuration of this melancholia, which has come to characterize so many things about the moment we're in. Initially, I think, I glimpsed it in the vulnerable feminine form of Enoch Powell's aged white woman, taunted, if you remember, by the wide-grinning pickaninnies, who, if you recall the mythography of that Rivers of Blood speech, taunted her with the word racialist, because in defiance of the race relations legislation newly introduced by the Labour government, she had unreasonably refused to rent out rooms in her decaying house to these interlopers. The post-colonial intruders from the new Commonwealth accomplished, in this mythography, what the Nazis had failed to do. They destroyed an unsuspecting nation from within. Of course, Powell's focus on housing and dwelling echoes more recent conflicts, but that coincidence tends not to draw the same degree of interpretive attention as the easier notion that these conflicts are unavoidable features, consequences of race and cultural difference. We often forget that the power and the plausibility of Powell's prophecy of racial war was won through the way that his ghastly predictions coincided with the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. The teleology that makes North America into an image of Britain's political future raises a range of more general problems. But in this area, we can say that our leaders are, I think, still being caught out by their inability to imagine a future for Britain's racial politics that is not deduced from US history. The US exemplified the only racial destiny that the British punditocracy could also conceive. And there is now some catching up for both groups to do. In my view, important opportunities arise both from seeking a future elsewhere and from seeing in our own recent history things from which other nations and governments might profit. Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilizations linked urgent international problems to the prospect of growing cultural diversity inside the US some years ago, although the book tends not to be read that way. His most recent work, Who Are We?, presents the flood of overly fertile immigrants from Latin America as, and I'm quoting now, the single most immediate and serious challenge to America's traditional identity. I don't know how you judge the march of the denizens through the streets of America's downtowns, but there may be something, there may be other ways. There must be other ways of addressing that question than the one that he's offered. Anyway, his sense of the connection between immigration and cultural diversity has moved into the center of respectable reflections on how multiculture should be governed. And the conflict between legals and illegals, between citizens and denizens, is endowed with strong cultural flavors to deploy the strong cultural flavors deployed to obscure the lingering aftertastes of racial hierarchy. What matters more than that, though, is that long before Hurricane Katrina projected the routine features of America's racial nomos across the world, Britain's history had been telling us that the US needn't be the inevitable destination of our racial politics, that America couldn't be the land of the future that it was for Hegel. This country outgrew the 1960s model which associated integration and immigration in government policy. And two generations beyond their coupling, the anxieties which fuel contemporary concern about the integrity of national culture and national identity have, in my view, different sources. Their origins lie not, as we're routinely told, obsessively told, in immigration, but in broader effects of globalization, in deindustrialization and in decolonization, in increased inequality and insecurity, yes, in privatization, particularly of housing, and in the regressive modernization promoted by the managers, the ideologues, and the info warriors of neoliberalism. All those forces shape the turmoil into which immigrants, aliens, and most recently, of course, asylum seekers and refugees have been thrown, and for which they are held responsible. The emergence of better, richer, and more satisfying explanations is blocked by that melancholia. After World War II, the white working class distaste for new Commonwealth's invading aliens was amplified by another, deeper discomfort. New sources of guilt, new sources of resentment arose with the pressure to face up to what the brutal administration of the British Empire had involved, especially during the wars fought by that last generation of national service conscripts. As the mechanisms of belated reparation and litigation start to move now, more of the shameful things done in the name of Crown and country have been revealed. Yet people persist in denying that those crimes, even in places like Zimbabwe and Iran, could have anything to do with the bitter conflicts of the post-colonial present. The small Cold Wars and low-intensity operations in Kenya, in Cyprus, in Korea, in Aden, in Malaya, and in Ireland, of course, many other locations, have slipped out of official national memory and been replaced by a sort of horrible cast of jaunty spectres drawn from propagandistic fare like the Dambusters and the Great Escape. If it returns at all, the final 20th century phase of Britain's decolonization comes back through a nostalgic filter, where the writings of John Masters, of E.M. Forster, and Paul Scott have all lately reacquired relevance by virtue of their ability to supply some solid old answers to disconcerting questions that their successors have been intimidated out of asking. What was the moral economy of the empire? Did it involve doing things about which we might reasonably be expected to feel ashamed and perhaps apologize? Does torturing people involve damage to the torturers as well as their victims, and so on? Against this, the mythology of the Blitz as a pure organic community is critical. And it was contested in the aftermath of last July's bombings by a different, and I'm tempted to say healthier, view of London as a dynamic, as a heterocultural world city. That ephemeral emanation of the mayor's office was, I think, a wishful development, but it raised the possibility that we might at last have reached the limits of that imploded two world wars and one world cup mentality. However, the frequency and the piety with which those old triumphs are summoned provides a barometer of something like the national state of mind, and the news from that front does not look encouraging. The key revelation is not so much that a majority of British people now support the policies of the BNP, as the pollsters reveal, it's that the level of their enthusiasm falls markedly when they're made aware that the policies they favour do not recognise as neo-fascist originate from the ultra-right. This phenomenon confirms that today the political forms of racism are not what they were 25 years ago when the half-bricks were flying overhead. Long struggles against racial hierarchy have introduced a significant measure of shame into the moral equations. Querying the elemental force of that traditional preamble, I'm not racist, but those fragile gains need to be acknowledged. But sadly, they don't mean that Britain's chronic problems in this area have been solved. Any successes in the transition towards self-conscious plurality have either derived from the unacknowledged and, in some cases, resented impact of 1970s cultural anti-racism, something that needs to be sharply distinguished from its governmental counterparts, or they have been inadvertent. These pluses have not been tested either by changing economic circumstances or by the fact that the British ultra-right still lacks charming, charismatic, or eloquent leadership untainted by associations with the ideals and underground institutions of National Socialism. Though they feature formulaic denunciations of the BNP, the xenophobia and the hostility of much of the popular press here recycles the political imaginary of the ultra-right, colludes in circulating their political demands as well. The recoding of these motifs in the world of official politics suggests, in turn, that government, fearful of being outflanked on the populist right, has opted to move debate back towards the era when anxiety over that overloaded signifier, immigration, supplied the catalyst for authoritarian and ultranationalist political organization. Media interpretation of the BNP revival, the new reverence with which the memory of the great parliamentarian Enoch Powell is now routinely invoked, debates about the integrity of the concept of racism, its place in British political life, have all told the same dismal story. And huge amounts of political energy have been expended on elaborate denials of the fact that racism is historically or politically significant as such, or in opposing the horrible idea that racism might be connected in any way to healthy nationalism and robust patriotism. Poor Orwell's peerless legacy suffers greatly from being made to produce warrants for these horrible exercises in mystification. In trying to understand this state of affairs, it helps also to appreciate the extent to which ideas of racial hierarchy were enmeshed with imperial domination from the very beginnings of European expansion and have been intrinsic to the making of this country into a global power. All of us who write on race and racism and empire are indebted to Hannah Arendt for her brilliant and flawed attempts to link the history of industrialized genocide to a prehistory in the colonial spaces of death and racialized misrule. She saw that process with clarity in part because she was alert to the significance of race and the forms of power it animated, even if for her, racism remained part of the legitimate reactions of civilized Europeans to savages, a problem that, of course, would lead her disastrously to misread the civil rights struggles in the US. Despite that, though, Arendt's insights remain inspiring because of the way she refuses culturalist views of the politics of racial hierarchy and because of the great creativity with which she conceptualized the still unpalatable connections between war, colonial administration, and genocide within Europe. The first multiculture, the vivid hybridity of the initial contact zones, had to be extinguished in order for the colonial order to become secure. Early ideas about race and about what we now call ethnicity were pernicious even in their pre-scientific incarnation. They were both tacit and explicit presences in English political theory from the days when John Locke winked at the colonists and gave the thumbs up to their wars of expropriation, and Hobbes's Leviathan was published against the backdrop provided by the passage of the Navigations Act, which formally initiated the legal and economic consolidation of the empire. The history of these English traditions of thought is becoming significant again in the context of debates over what is to count as a proper history in our national curriculum, conflicts that are, of course, paralleled in other post-colonial countries like France and Japan. It would appear now that the triumph of the Tudors and the defeat of the Nazis are not enough to orient the nation either to its new military missions in the world or to its properly patriotic and culturally integrated relationship with the ethnically purified version of heritage that emerges from the air raid shelters where sugary tea is drunk and Cockney songs are sung. English traditions of theoretical reflection on the politics and the morality of colonial government are also relevant here because a self-conscious revival of imperial ambitions has helped to define the mediation of infowar and morbid multiculturalism, as well as to set new standards for the evaluation of national belonging and the meaning of our citizenship. Of course, the country's been deeply divided over the significance of imperialism in its past, as well as the wisdom of reviving the civilizing mission in Mesopotamia, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. Britain's imperial ambitions are frequently, in the past anyway, swathed in humanitarian rhetoric, and the humanitarian component needs to be addressed separately. It might be thought to remain pending, having been updated and refined in some of these contemporary discussions of debt and poverty reduction. I emphasize those problems tonight because understanding the economic and political and moral impact of imperialism inside this country and beyond it was previously a mainstream concern among scholars based in this institution. An attitude that might be worth reviving and extending further, notwithstanding, of course, the notable contributions of so many colleagues who have continued this effort. Since I came here, I've become interested in the political and intellectual horizons of those like L.T. Hobhouse, who were involved in organizing the Universal Races Congress here in London in 1911. That pivotal event drew on the ethical and intellectual spirit of this university, and is not remembered as often as it should be, given the current academic vogue for cosmopolitan thinking, which is so often addressed as if it was only a matter for the late 18th century. The organizers of the Congress felt themselves to be a cosmopolitical elite, plucked from across the planet. They saw that world as one place and worked in the light of their perception to avert the looming catastrophe of the First World War, which they judged to be fueled by imperialist expansion and economic rivalry. They wanted to prepare people locally for the historical and geopolitical changes that would arise, they argued, when Japan and China encountered Europe and the US as equals rather than as racial inferiors. Lord Weardale's introduction to the collected conference papers makes these concerns explicit. Let me quote it briefly. "Nearer and nearer, we see approaching the day when the vast populations of the East will assert their claim to meet on terms of equality with the nations of the West, when the free institutions and organized forces of one hemisphere will have their counterbalance in the other, when their mental outlook and their social aims will be, in principle, identical, and when, in short, color prejudice will have vanished, and the so-called white races and the so-called colored races shall regard one another in truth as men and brothers." The organizers cast their pursuit of peace, of social reform, of what they termed the modern conscience, and universal humanity as a critique of the ambitions of the great national states as they careered towards their doom in industrialized war. And the African-American sociologist W.E.B. Du Bois spoke for all the delegates when looking back at the event in one of his autobiographies. He had this to say about it. "I fancied at the time I knew my Europe pretty well, but familiarity with the dangers of the European scene had bred contempt for disaster. I thought with other philosophers that a general European war was impossible. The economic and cultural strands among nations had grown too strong to be snapped by war. World peace, world organization, conferences and conciliation, the gradual breaking down of trade barriers, the spread of civilization to backward peoples, the emancipation of suppressed groups, like the American Negro, seemed to me the natural and the inevitable path of world progress." Unquote. Not long before, of course, the proponents of this kind of thinking around progress had imagined that the world's backward and unfit people were doomed and would simply vanish with the inevitable global advance of white civilization. In the Congress itself, that monopoly of historicity and developmental momentum was challenged and hijacked by social liberal and cosmopolitan forces for whom internationalism and nationalism were not to be counterposed. Du Bois' later disenchantment with all this testifies to the defeat of the organizers' utopian conceptions at the hands of the envy and jealousy of imperial powers. That's his phrase, not mine. Well, of course, sentiments of this sort have gone right out of fashion in our post-colonial world. And in their place, we hear arguments not against gunboat diplomacy and double standards, but for their extension, for the revival of imperial rule under the lightest of touches, in voluntary forms, forms that can promote early intervention into the pre-modern chaos and incompetent government by enlightened Europe's postmodern weaponry. These arguments are not, as I'm sure you know, monopolized by the right. It's significant that their advocates, from whatever political direction they hail, are entirely untroubled by and sometimes even assertive about their active disinterest in the detail of the country's imperial and colonial history, and indeed of the histories of colonial rule and colonial war involving other European powers, So again, agnotology is relevant. Interventions by the advocates of revived colonial rule, for whom the recent writings of the diplomat Robert Cooper supply a valuable paradigm case, have appeared in tandem with an explosion of popular revisionist accounts of colonial life, which in the context of the woeful state of British publishing is something of a sociological and political phenomenon in its own right. This body of work has, I think, made the history of empire and colony into a dynamic issue, an issue which is bound up with the possibility of multiculturalism. What you might call happy-clappy approaches to the lost glories of the imperial past have become inspiring now, many, in a geopolitical situation where the revival of empire has been explicitly demanded by those who are most keen to link the present power of the US to the global dominance enjoyed by Britain in the past. Those widely read works, notably by Niall Ferguson and Linda Colley, Saul David, do more than just gloss over the rationally applied barbarity of Britain's colonial phases. These authors, like the populist politicians, the media xenophobes, and the prospect commentariat, trade in the absurd idea that the British are the primary victims of their own colonial history. An awareness that has been judged to be the best precondition for the revival of empire abroad and the rebirth of this homogenous neo-imperial spirit at home, two ambitions which were until recently integral to the Blair government's conception of our reformed nation's happy future. Understood in association with that other article of faith, the refusal of racism, the historical significance of this bid to monopolize victimage is revealed by the way that these restorative themes resonate within the arc of Britain's own post-colonial crisis. There, hostility to multiculturalism, enthusiasm for civilizationism, supply sort of load-bearing pillars for a monumental common sense, which is fully compatible with the deeply and comfortably racialized conception of geopolitical conflict. It may not be only the US special forces who see the Iraqis as Untermenschen. Guantanamo can be connected both historically and juridically to Belmarsh and to Yarlswood and to Campsfield House. A nationalist counterpart to the belligerent parochialism of those football fans who sing "No one likes us, we don't care," combines often with this neurotically intense desire to refill the painfully empty shell of national identity. And the force of that blend has led many to seek cultural resources for British renewal and rebirth, not only in these carefully airbrushed accounts of the imperial past, but also in resurgent monarchy, in sport, most obviously, and if those options fail, in the comforting contours of abstract white supremacy, enacted perhaps on the battlefield, or more likely performed in the streets, where, as the murders of Anthony Walker and Christopher Alaneme suggest, another doctrine of preemption can prevail. The same underlying cultural and psychological pathology has found some notable political expressions recently. In Gordon Brown's impossibly contradictory declaration that on the one hand we must revive interest in what was thought to be a discredited notion of Britishness, and on the other that all apologising for the empire must now cease. Brown told the Daily Mail that, and I'm quoting now, Britain no longer had to make excuses for its record as a colonial power, adding, I've talked to many people on my visit to Africa, and the days of Britain having to apologize for its colonial history are over. We should move forward. Well, the residual literary critic in me is attentive to the rhetorical displacement of that timely perception onto his eager African interlocutors. But never mind. I suppose the signature New Labour desire to move on imposes constraints on this revisionist history. And it bears repetition that this history's popular appeal, whether it's served up by the cheerleaders of empire or in more tepid forms by writers uncomfortable with the prospect of Britain playing Greece to the US Rome, lies in the odd way that the Brits, rather than the peoples they slaughtered, exploited, and enslaved, emerge as the primary victims of this grand imperial project. Of course, it's significant that the broad appeal of this particular combination of themes, Britain as victim and Britain as righteously victorious, is seldom identified as a sociological or political problem and analyzed as such. I think that luxury shouldn't continue. It shouldn't continue because the national obsession with World War II and the belligerent nationalism and racism that's so often alloyed with it suggests that the renewed engagement with identity reproduces and perhaps even intensifies these disabling symptoms of melancholia. Identity is, as you all know, I'm sure, the name and the principal focus of the British National Party's in-house journal, The blend in which the figure of victim and victor, figures of victim and victor get fused together is linked both to this denial of racism or to the fit-in or clear-off version of assimilationism, which is now politically favoured. The historian Edith Zertal reminds us that the pathways of national identity and historical memory routinely intersect at the graveside. She argues that the combination of victim and victor is especially potent in shaping nationalism's postmodern expressions. And to me, the uncontrolled repetition of Britain's heroic triumph against the Third Reich serves this machinery of melancholia as both a screen and a filter. It blocks out both imperial and colonial history and prevents access to the wars of decolonization. The disappearance of all those nation-building post-colonial conflicts in Palestine, Kenya, Aden, Malaya, Ireland, Cyprus, and so on and so on, encourages this mistaken belief, a fundamental problem, that the empire was too long ago to remain relevant to contemporary realities. Freud describes melancholia as a state of pathological sadness, interspersed with manic elation, guilty self-hatred, and disgust. It is, he tells us, a condition of shamelessness. Of course, guilt abounds there. The loss that triggers the symptoms will not be worked through. The lost object is gone, but its loss promotes a limitless grief that is expressed in destructive forms. For Britain, that guilt and that anguish lie in disavowed identification with the empire and its crimes. Knowledge of them is repressed, but the empire cannot be let go. Chicken tikka is now the national dish, and in a few weeks we will see how manic elation can be articulated around mass sports spectatorship. Largely undetected, either by government or by media, thankfully, Britain's migrants and settlers and their descendants have generated some more positive possibilities. Other varieties of interaction have developed alongside the usual tales of crime and conflict. And these patterns involve not a mosaic pluralism along US lines in which each self-sustaining and carefully segregated element is located so as to enhance a larger picture, but an unruly convivial mode of interaction in which differences have to be negotiated in real time. Britain's civic life has been endowed with a multiculture that we do not always value or use wisely. And in many instances, convivial social forms have sprouted spontaneously and unappreciated from the detritus of Roy Jenkins' failed mid-1960s experiments with integration. Conviviality is a social pattern in which different metropolitan groups dwell in close proximity, but where their racial, their linguistic, and their religious particularities do not, as the logic of ethnic absolutism suggests they should, add up to discontinuities of experience or insuperable problems of communication. In these conditions, a degree of differentiation can be combined with a large measure of overlapping, something that was vividly apparent to me in the carnival crowd swirling around Highbury last weekend. That's an interesting example because there the cosmopolis on the pitch has come to correspond in some complex and interesting ways with the cosmopolis around it. There are, of course, institutional and demographic and generational and educational and legal and political commonalities, as well as elective variations that intercut the dimensions of difference and complicate the desire to possess and manage the cultural habits of others as a function of one's own relationship with identity. Conviviality acknowledges that complexity, and though it cannot banish conflict, can be shown, I think, to equip people with a means of managing it in their own interests and in the interests of others with whom they might be induced heteropathically to identify. Now, recognizing that conviviality should not signify the absence of racism. Instead, it could convey the idea that alongside racism's institutional interpersonal effects, the means of racism's overcoming have also evolved. Racism is still there, it's still souring things, still distorting economic relations, still debasing public life, but it's now articulated together with the ambivalent mainstreaming of black culture. Conviviality promotes that combination, which does not represent the end of Britain's immigration problems, though it might herald the uncoupling of all of that from the political rules specified previously by Enoch Powell's belligerent imagination. Of course, the plurality itself is mutating, shifting into more complex and challenging forms. Even that black community centered on Caribbean life and history is disappearing, as it moves towards a different African majority. In this convivial culture, then, racial and ethnic differences have been rendered unremarkable. That's the promise. In Raymond Williams' distinctive sense of the word, they've been able to become ordinary. Instead of adding to the premium of race as political ontology and economic fate, people discover that things which really divide them now are much more profound: taste, lifestyle, their leisure preferences. By making racial difference appear ordinary, appear banal, even boring, convivial interaction, even when it's promoted by devices like reality television, has disseminated everyday virtues that enrich our cities, drive our cultural industries, and enhance our struggling democracy so that it resists the pressure to operate in segregated and color-coded forms. Exposure to otherness, as this institution demonstrates every day, can involve more than jeopardy. Conviviality inspires us to demand a more mature polity that, even if it's not entirely free of racism, might be better equipped to deal with racial inequality and cultural plurality as matters of politics without lapsing into unproductive guilt and narcissistic anguish. The first conclusion that emerges from this brief survey is that the supposed unbridgeable gulf between civilizations can be easily spanned. This was an epiphany that came across very strongly in the tales told by homecoming British detainees about their incarceration in the Guantanamo camps and their lives before and since. Those men often, of course, as you would expect, presented as having reverted to alien type, as symbols of the failure of multicultural society. It seems to me that since their return, the discussions of their experience have begun to prompt processes of reflection and recognition that have overturned that governmental apple cart emblazoned with the fatal Kafkaesque phrase, "They must have done something wrong." Jamal Al-Harith, the Mancunian website designer of Jamaican descent, was the first of them to speak and to reveal how far the country had travelled from some of those 1960s recipes for assimilation. He explained that in articulating the strongest desires for freedom and relief from the camp regime, he and his fellow inmates had said that what they really craved was a packet of Highland shortbread. Another returning, the Brummy Muazzin Beg, who was here on the stage yesterday lunchtime, actually, and has written a very interesting account of his life, tells us that even when he was held in solitary confinement, he could make a sustaining dialogue with his guards, that he read Harry Potter and even received a helpful gift of Jeremy Paxman's The English from one of his MI6 interrogators, something which lends new dimension to the discussion of torture, I suppose. Beg explains that his father had him educated in a Jewish school. And that decision, which I think, in the context of his book, which I urge you to look at, reveals some profound things about migrancy and assimilation, which defy simplistic civilizationism and imperialistic political theology alike. Let me quote briefly from his book. "From an early age, my father enrolled us both at a Jewish primary school. His seemingly odd choice was entirely pragmatic. King David, with its high standards of education and emphasis on religious and moral ethics, coupled with kosher dietary laws similar to our own, was the ideal option for him. But the choice also demonstrated my father's liberalism, his desire to take what was best from all cultures. It laid the foundations for the type of religious teaching that I became so interested in as I grew older." Well, of course, the lives of the 7th of July bombers and, of course, of their victims must be placed in rather different categories from these innocent returnees. But those lives also yield resources to illustrate and to fill out the social characteristics of this convivial interaction. The multilingual and cosmopolitan lives of many of the victims have, I think, become reasonably well known through a process of public grieving for them that has shown, to me anyway, that it would be wrong to assume their murder represented nothing more than another view of that opposition between solidarity and diversity. More difficult point is that nobody involved in these events seems to have lived comfortably, bounded by culture, language, religion, race, or history, from which they were unable to escape. Even the bombers seem to have had problems conforming to the rules of the ethnic absolutism they had chosen. Their Manichaeism delirium might also be read as a response to culture's protean qualities. Of course, we're not yet in a position to know how political, cultural, and generational shifts in their own ethnically bounded communities, the demise of the Asian youth movements and so on, may have contributed to a radical estrangement. But the combination of integration and Yorkshire apartheid suggests that the dimensions of a bigger political problem than one that can be effectively managed by history tests, better punctuation, and more language classes. Mohammed Sadiq Khan, in his tape, and we have every reason to be skeptical of it, claims his murderous act was an ethical one. It makes clear that he, at least, seems to have taken the rhetoric of the war on terror at face value. We are at war, and I am a soldier. Now you, too, will taste the reality of this situation. Of course, the only actual immigrant among the four terrorist bombers was the Jamaican-born convert, Jermaine Lindsay, who, as we are told, did not speak Arabic, did not attend the local mosque in Aylesbury, or mix with the largely Pakistani Muslim community there. I think there is a challenge to map these lives and the lives of the victims, the lives of the returnees, onto a different understanding of this cultural moment in the breakdown of multicultural. Now, I think the London Cosmopolis generates these new interpretive challenges every day. Certainly my Portuguese is beginning to improve as a result of my bus journey since I got back here, though my Polish is lagging some way behind it. The point is more that the focus on conviviality asks us to look at this city as it is now, and not through the version of Enoch's Nightmares reanimated by David Goodhart, John Lloyd, Bob Rowthorne, Michael Collins, and the rest of them. We can draw on the spirit of Jean-Charles de Menezes here, who constituted a presence so extravagantly unimaginable to his executioners that it could only be misrecognized in the racial archetype of a Mongolian-eyed IC4. The punditocracy has not used up much ink in exploring his place in this city, never mind the lives of those other Brazilian denizens in their multi-occupied Lambeth bedsit, which sounded like a throwback to Elspeth Huxley's Backstreet New Worlds. The conviviality to which I am inviting you to commit requires that we ask how his alien presence in London became inconceivable to power and to law, how the logic of race hierarchy contributed to his fate, and in a way that might be thought of to counterpoint the rather different case of the Morecambe Bay cockle collectors, how making sense of these deaths necessitates moving beyond that limited logic. Of course, governmental collusion in the operations of the market that puts rock-bottom prices on these varieties of life and labour must be grasped. But the focus of this post-colonial analysis involves more than just revisiting the well-worn issue of culture versus economics. Understanding the significance of the unfolding difference between citizens and denizens demands a more complex model for thinking about plurality than the old defaults. They suggested that tastes and cultures and needs and habits could all be lined up and managed as part of a pact that nudged people towards their citizenship, essentially through their experience as cultural clients of government, with faith schools and lottery money as the favored currency in this quid pro quo. Rather than seeking to cater politically for each group through the mastery of the sorts of cultural things that ought to correspond to its particularity, and then using that fidelity to secure affiliation to a larger national community, there must, I think, be recognition that diversity now means more than just feeding and reproducing the particularity of those groups imagined by their community leaders in the hope that their ritual and formal inclusion will generate a reciprocal gesture. That version of multiculturalism has failed. It effectively placed a few people in charge of saying what the cultural habits of the whole group should be, and then sealed up communities in a version of their past bound to fixed forms of hierarchy as well as to mechanical electoral mobilization. That is a colonial arrangement, and it not only guarantees nothing by way of commitment to larger plural identity, it misunderstands culture fundamentally and oversimplifies it so that it is conceived as a kind of ethnic property to be owned, to be held under copyright. The vital alternative that I've tried to signal with this concept of convivial multiculture is different. It's a sort of open source co-production that violates those laws of copyright. Sustaining and valuing that conviviality may yet become legitimate goals in a larger strategy for bringing British citizenship to life. That attractive possibility demands acts of creativity and imagination on the part of planners, on the part of politicians, and yes, on the part of sociologists as well. Thank you.
Well, as you are almost certainly aware that Lord Giddens is a Tottenham Hotspur supporter, if you persist in including positive references to the Arsenal Cosmopolis in your speeches, there may not be very more of them to come. But apart from that, let me throw it open to questions. And if you could, before you ask your question, wait for a microphone and say who you are, that would be very helpful. Who can I identify? This is always the worst thing, that nobody wants to ask a question first. And then when I say the last question, I get about 30 hands. Down here, yeah. Can we... Man in a red shirt.
Thank you. My name's Adam Swinburne. I was at LSE last year. You touched briefly on the rather awkward fact that the BNP has got perhaps more support from the population than one might hope. Can you offer any ideas on how the government should respond to that support, as opposed to the party itself, but to the fact that I think one in four white British adults has actually considered voting for the BNP?
Well, I mean, I mean, the simplest thing, I didn't actually try to suggest that the more people supported the BNP than one would like. I was trying to suggest that people have these feelings and commitments, and when they're told that they emanate from the BNP, they suddenly become less enthusiastic. That was the force of my point. It doesn't surprise me that a large number of people support these ideas. As I said, they are amplified by the much of the popular press, which colludes in the recycling of this particular specification of the problems of the country. And of course, as I also tried to suggest, there are many people in the government and around it who endorse this essentially power-like sort of landscape of what those a plight of those people might be. My view about this is that the first thing the government should do is not think that it can play with these symbols and signs and forms of language in a way that forestalls a populist eruption. I think that much of what protects us from that is the fact that we're still dealing with an old leadership. The Nick Griffin generation of people are the ones who are still Nazis, actually. I mean, and but there's a limit in using that affiliation to expose them. After a while, that ceases to have any actual meaning. The danger is that the government actually colludes in all of this by thinking that it can outflank the populist possibility by recycling or bringing to life certain threads of that political package, managing it. You know, when I decided to go and live abroad was just after the election of New Labour, and I remember having a quarrel with Tony Wright, MP, the following day. It was a symposium to talk about what had gone on, and I said, you know, there were only two political leaders who went and had their photographs taken by the White Cliffs of Dover, Tony. One was John Tyndall, and the other one was Tony Blair. This was the era of Fritz, the ironically named bulldog, okay? So this, to me, suggested that we could go to some sort of, ideographic sandbox, take out the symbols of nationality, and play around with them, you know? And what bothered me about that was really that it was an option that only seemed a viable political strategy if one hadn't really taken the sort of powerful force and congealed violence in all of this into account. So I think because it was judged to be a peripheral matter, people didn't really think seriously about what was at stake in that repertoire, in that language. And I think that problem has persisted. And sometimes one wonders about whether, you know, David Blunkett enjoyed playing this sort of pantomime villain who comes out with all of this stuff. This is always a mission which is giving to the quote-unquote working class members of the political class to communicate. That's their problem to solve. I feel, I don't know whether this was being done, how deliberately it was being done, but I think that my hunch tells me it was being done very deliberately. And that is also apart from the abandonment and retreat of Labour from places like Barking, you know, which are not part of the electoral calculation that keeps government where it is, that recycling of BNP motifs, of ultra-right language and politics is the first thing that should be stopped.
Yeah, third row up there.
Hi, Paul. This is Matthew Kabatoff. I'm just wondering what you see as the consequences of, say, adopting a more branded American melting pot version of immigration in this country versus, say, what you've proposed as a cosmopolis, this sort of open source, variegated, plural system?
Well, to me, American patriotism is a very complex phenomenon. It's much misunderstood by people who haven't been exposed to it at length. I mean, you know, I don't really think of the United States as one country, and I think of it as several countries in effect, each regions with their own strong linguistic, cultural habits, economic lives. They're not, and so I think that the peculiar religion of American patriotism is bound up with all sorts of things, but one of them is holding that plurality together. So what troubles me really is, again, a certain sort of shallowness in assuming that some off-the-shelf US recipe can somehow be folded straightforwardly into the life of our country where it doesn't belong, you know. I mean, nobody talks, I mean, you know, there are countries, of course, where there's a flagpole in every garden, you know, but the United States is only one of them, you know. I mean, when you're in Sweden, for example, you see a lot of Swedes flying the flag. No one talks about that as a model we should be thinking about. I had the pleasure and experience of going to hear Gordon Brown give that speech at the Fabian Society event where I was also speaking, and I was very struck by the fact that as he came onto the podium and the flag had been carefully positioned behind him, they wheeled out the black people and positioned them on the stage left so that the cameras would take the picture of him in front of the flag with them in the immediate background. So when I saw that particular bit of dramaturgy, I was even more troubled, actually, because it suggests a certain kind of ambivalence about. So perhaps it is more conscious. There is a great deal more self-consciousness involved in thinking about the volatility of this particular package. So I don't like the idea of an off-the-shelf American recipe for patriotism. I don't like the... there are other features of this that I dislike more. I don't like the way that Orwell's legacy and Orwell's contribution to distinguishing patriotism and nationalism from one another becomes a sort of leitmotif for a whole set of rather problematic things. So I don't think it's the only problem. But the ambivalence of England's relationship with the United States, of Britain's relationship with the United States, is sort of pending in all of that too, I think. And, you know, a year or two at the Kennedy School of Government is not sufficient anthropological experience with American patriotism to justify that commitment.
I must say, I thought that Gordon Brown's belated interest in Britishness was because he was concerned about the potential English backlash against a Scottish Prime Minister, but perhaps that's an over-cynical interpretation. Was there somebody down here? Yeah, could you... Green cardigan, dare I call it? Yes.
Thank you very much. You mentioned George Orwell just now, and of course he wrote a lot on this particular subject, and I'd be interested if you'd talk about that. And also, I'd just bring in a little bit of something else. That England has been an open country for 2,000 years, well before the Romans, and... you know, I'm rather optimistic. While we're looking at looking rather closely at the present situation, within four or five generations, I think that a lot of the tensions that we now have will somehow iron themselves out. And I've got a very strong feeling about that. But I'd be interested if you've got any comments of that nature.
Well, I mean, one thing that the Romans didn't have to worry about in managing their diversity and their imperial rule was the idea that the people that they managed were anxious about becoming a minority in the context of a larger majority. One of the things that struck me very strongly in some of the things that were coming out of Barking was this anxiety that people had that they were becoming a minority in their own country, you know. And I think that particular fear, you know, needs to be addressed in its own right, and it's related not only to the emergence of demography as a kind of master discourse, but to this question I tried to raise earlier on of a sort of abstract whiteness, which is another US import, you know, the idea, and I mentioned Michael Collins' book. He's somebody who has particularly won the George Orwell Prize, incidentally, for his book, you know, which says that, you know, talking about white trash is a sort of acceptable racial epithet, and that's really the people of the East End were sort of somehow suffered a sort of secondariness as a result of the attention that was given to the murder of Stephen Lawrence and other rather odd things like that. So I think this question of what it is to shift from having been a majority to suddenly imagining oneself as a minority you know, I suppose this is a trope that can be tracked back quite a long way to the swamping speech and so on. But it's something that needs to be addressed in its own particular way. Orwell, I mentioned agnotology, the cultural production of ignorance, and Orwell's sort of interested in the relation between ignorance and certain forms of nationalism too. His definition of nationalism is a very expanded one, and it carries it's a portmanteau term that carries all sorts of unsavory contents with it. One of the things he says about nationalism is that the nationalist has the ability not to even hear or to learn about the bad things which are done in the name of their own side. And so I think that's something I'm particularly interested in, is how this ignorance is maintained and reproduced over time. Now, the other thing about Orwell and the selectivity with which his legacy is drawn on, it relates, I think, very crudely to the parts of his work that were connected to his experiences of being an imperial policeman, a colonial policeman, and the parts of his work which are salvageable within the sort of landscape of a sort of nostalgic England, the England which is the one that triggers the appearance of the welfare state, actually. And I think that those two components of his work are seldom reconciled. And what I tried to do, what interests me in the things I've written about him, is really to bring the Orwell as the imperial policeman and his distinctive critique of his experiences of imperial policing, of colonial policing, in essays like A Hanging or in the one that he wrote about Killing the Elephant, which we were all made to read so that we learned how to write English and so on. Those sorts of things are actually much more important to the version of his memory that I want to engage, and which I think yields a lot in this discussion of the kind of Gordon Brown variety.
Question in the sort of fourth row, sort of the middle. I must say, sir, congratulations. The first time since I've been at the LSE that anyone's asked the "what did the Romans do for us" question, which I've been sort of looking forward to. Yeah.
Awad Juma from SAWAS. We often hear that Britain is better than France. How would you answer such a question?
Well, it's an interesting question. You know, we know the wogs begin at Calais, so that's the first thing we need to think about. But what would I say? I'd say that both countries could be thought of as being touched by the sort of iron hand of post-colonial melancholia. I mean, I don't think that the relationship of the French to their colonial adventures, not only in Algeria, but in Vietnam and in other places, has reached a kind of stage of self-consciousness. I mean, I think that there's a lot of melancholic refusal and denial bound up with the fact that, I don't know, that you can slaughter people in this. I mean, what would have happened if they'd killed 200 people and dumped them in the Thames? Do you think we'd have all shut up about it for 45 years? I don't really think we would. So I think there's a value in actually developing a sort of systematic comparative typology of some of these things that relate to the recent histories of different European countries. The French case lends itself immediately to that, not least, of course, as I said earlier on, because they're struggling over what their history curriculum should involve and what version of the imperial and colonial past should be recycled in the life of their educational institutions. But there are other examples too. I mean, the Portuguese relationship to their history of colonization is another interesting case, one which is bound up, I think, very much with the building of democracy in that country too. So I think, you know, I would like to develop a much less, you know, inward version of reflection on post-colonial political relations in different areas of the EU, and I think we have resources for doing that. Recently, I was involved in a session on Nordic colonialism held in Greenland, you know, where the Greenlanders are actually getting rather annoyed with the Danes, with good reason. Oh. So I think, you know, I think there are many versions of these particular complex that are in circulation in different places, and one of the interesting things that's going to happen in the period ahead is that we begin to talk to one another and organise across national boundaries in the way that we must do, I think.
Woman red cardigan there. Thanks.
Hi, Sandra Jovchalovich, Institute of Social Psychology here at the school. I was very intrigued, Paul, by the psychological emphasis of your lecture, and I wanted to ask you a bit more about what you called convivial multiculture, especially in relation to the possibilities that are opened up by zones of contact that you pointed to. We usually tend to think about what self, and especially dominant selves, can do to the other, and not so much about what the other can do to self. So I was wondering if you could explore a bit more, how do you see zones of perhaps redemption or dialogue in this history of tragedies and difficulties, and if you think that perhaps other historical and cultural experiences can inform what's happening here. And I'm thinking especially about the experience of multicultural in places like Latin America that are radically different from North America and Europe.
I think I want to reserve the concept of the contact zone to a particular phase in the development of colonial expansion. I don't want to use the idea of a contact zone to explore the kind of convivial social processes in a city like this, because it seems to me that then you become hostage to a certain set of mosaic settings about how people dwell and the constitution and the territorial, the spatial integrity of their communities. So I think, for me, the concept of conviviality comes into my thinking from Illich's book, Tools for Conviviality, which is about the pedagogy of post-industrial societies. And I think behind that intervention and behind that choice lies a history of the Iberian Peninsula, of the convivencia, of people over many centuries actually organizing their social and institutional life, not to be free of conflict, but towards a kind of cohabitation. And there are some interesting versions of this in the life of particular cities that we can identify, but seldom something so self-consciously folded back into a kind of national story. And so that interests me very much. But the key, I think, to this question, that I hear in your question anyway, really relates to this question of the issue of the future, about what it is to renounce the idea that with regard to questions of race and ethnicity and politics, that the United States stands as the future of this country. And that was something that was sort of drummed into me as a student, something that I felt as a child, you know, when I really thought the rivers of blood would flow. I really actually believed that and worried about it. I couldn't go to sleep from thinking about it, you know. And it was only later on I realized that there wasn't a river in Birmingham, you know. So the sort of borrowing of the Tiber had some other function. I felt better when I worked that out. So I suppose I'd say that we can find other futures, you know, and we can seek them in Latin America and I'm sure there are Brazilian people here. I mean, the debates within Brazil about whether U.S. racial technology is going to be exported into their governmental apparatuses, whether people's identity cards are going to carry a racial classification and so on, whether affirmative action is the vehicle for managing the hopes and life chances of Afro-Brazilians, you know. I've been also very inspired through some of the conversations and humbled by some of the opportunities I've had to engage scholars and activists from South Africa, many problems, of course, remaining. But you know, there are certain possibilities and certain hopeful elements there, I think, which might, you know, help to rewrite the telos of racial politics in ways that are more interesting and more habitable. Whether or not there's a sort of psychological dimension to conviviality, I haven't, apart from the sort of the wishful, obvious wishful one, the utopian one, the dreaming forwards, if you like. I wouldn't like to say. I haven't really thought about what the psychological demands of a convivial culture would be. I mean, I do know that, you know, when my ex-next door neighbor's son was killed in the train at King's Cross, that there was no ethnic limit on the grieving of our neighborhood for that boy. You know? And it may well be also, and this is one of the reasons I tried to use the idea of shame in my talk and to counterpose shame and guilt, that actually there's something about shame itself which is important to this mechanism. Psychologically. When I was writing Between Camps, I had been working in the Fortune of Holocaust archive at Yale University, which is a video archive of testimony by survivors of the camps. And in that, I was very drawn to certain stories of survivors, and particularly also stories of the quote-unquote liberators of the camps, very often in particular the sorts of stories that were being told by African-American soldiers who'd arrived to clean up, or Japanese-American soldiers who'd been there. I was very interested in these stories because very often these stories, particularly by the quote-unquote liberators, involved stories of shame, feelings of great shame in the context of human suffering for which they were not responsible. But that feeling of shame interests me very much. And I suppose I would like to imagine, and again, I'm thinking on my feet, I haven't thought this through, but I would like to imagine that there's something about the thriving prospect of conviviality which is related to a sort of shameful life. I use the phrase ordinary virtue because I'm very interested also in Primo Levi. And Primo Levi has this extraordinary chapter on the shame that distorted his relationship with one of his fellow inmates, who he deprived of some water he found in a pipe one day when they were working in the camp. So I think, and shame is also something I think that's come out of conversations I've had with some of the anti-racist activists in this country who have talked about their engaging the ideologues of the BNP and these and their foot soldiers and trying not to deal with the people who work within the, what do you call it, hierarchy of credibility, you know, the people who don't believe the conspiracy but who offer it to their foot soldiers, but to work with people further down that hierarchy and to shame them out of their attachment to white supremacism and other forms of ultranationalist thinking. So for me, conviviality and shame are linked in some way that I haven't yet been able to map, but I have a hunch that they're connected in a way that's important.
A back row, all right up there.
Jessica Horner, former student of LSE. Thank you, firstly, as always, for the provocations and insights. And I suppose for me, what I'm most interested to hear from you is how you see gendered power weaving through this notion of convivial multiculturalism. Not least because women's rights has actually been used as part defense for the war on terror, saving Afghani women from the burqa, etc., etc., but also how multiculturalism in policy often denies women's understandings of culture. And that's coming in the UK very strongly in the ways that Islam is dealt with, the fact that there are no women spokespeople of Islam taken up by the establishment to, you know, and the fact that it's largely men also who are involved in this kind of terrorist, quote-unquote, violence.
Well, I mean, traditionally, the clash of civilizations is inscribed most powerfully on the bodies of women, and that's been true for a long time. And I don't know how to use that history except to say that it's something that I want to refute in the general refutation of that trivial account of culture. You're absolutely right to emphasize how much the liberation of women from Islam has been projected as the goal of the of these belligerent adventures. I suppose I'm inclined to mourn the loss of feminist voices in that. It seems to me that there's been a kind of silencing, a muting of the feminist critiques of that, and it's bound in my own thinking very much with the emergence of women into the US military, in the sense of the soldier citizen as the sort of last gasp of the bourgeois revolution, you know, and the sort of Lindy England figure is bound up with the, oh dear, I forget the name of the young woman who was captured. Jessica Lynch, sorry, yes. So you have Lindy England and Jessica Lynch as the ciphers of the completion of that bourgeois revolution, which allows access to the role of soldier citizen to women. And of course, many, many of the women, I think 50% of the women in the US military now, I don't know what the figures are in this country, are African American, you know. So that ought to be telling us something too about the way in which these things are played out. I mean, it's also true that the US military has been an extraordinary engine, in corporate terms, for the, what do you call it, for multicultural for multicultural management. And that's something too that we don't really like to talk about. I think all of these developments move us away from a sort of Manichaean or binary account of a blackness and whiteness as an adequate basis for thinking the politics of race geopolitically. Whether or not, as it were, a politics of sisterhood is practicable within these swirls of cultural conflict, I wouldn't like to say. It may well be that those sorts of differences and divisions between the experience of women in the overdeveloped countries and the experience of women in the developing countries and the developmentally arrested countries and the colonized countries and the war-torn countries, that those distinctions might need to be sharpened in the present situation, and that the practitioners of politics as the good life have to kind of defer to the practitioners of politics as the Will there be life the next day? And that there's a huge division there to which the politics of gender and the gendering of experiences is required to kind of required to be made to speak.
I think we might take. There are two hands up there. Why don't you both? No, God. I'll take those two together, and then I think we should probably wind up.
Hello, Amy Clark. I'm a master's student here. I was someone who grew up on images of a Great Britain of sweet tea in air raid shelters, and I recognise what you said, that represents something of a sort of distorted identity based in memory and so on. But I was wondering whether there was anything that you thought from historical British identity that could be preserved in your idea of a plural identity.
Thanks. Pass it along. We'll take you as well. We'll take these last three comments, Maud, if that's okay. Yeah.
Hi, Sarah Murphy. I'm a master's student here as well. You've referred to the British media as more or less overtly racist and conservative, which I'm not objecting to, but also the info warriors of neoliberalism. And I'm just, in relation to knowledge and information, I'm just wondering how useful you see it to stay within this dichotomy of wisdom and ignorance, because for me it's quite a colonial dichotomy, and I'm just wondering the place of the sociologist and the intellectual within that dichotomy, and whether you think that perhaps we should strive to stay outside of it. Thank you.
And then just one row back. Yeah, that's it.
Yes, this question is related to the last one in terms of what you mentioned as the moral economy. Could you please explain what it implies in terms of the victor and the victims you mentioned in the post-colonial period and the resurgence of the war and conflict as part of the new neoliberal agenda?
Three easy ones to finish with.
I suppose, you know, the key element in that moral economy is the value of the different value which is placed on life according to the rules of racial hierarchy. There are different body counts. Or in fact, the impulse to count death and measure it is unevenly distributed. And it seems to me that that's a source of shame. And the prospect of actually making different sorts of calculations about these, ends and means in the post-colonial wars that I've been speaking about might be relevant. And one of the reasons I appeal to the spirit of Hannah Arendt is that she was very, very critical of the eggs and omelets approach to geopolitics. I think she wrote an essay at one point in the 50s called "The Eggs Beat Back" or something like that, from the vantage point of all this sort of fuel for progress and development. So that moral economy, for me, is really about the value of life and the uneven, the variations in the way that those forms of value are calculated and manifested. With regard to the media, the dichotomy between wisdom and ignorance. I mean, there are only two of the possible categories. You know, there's stupidity and folly, and there's a sort of supplementary arsenal, if I'm allowed to use that word, of different categories that are relevant to this. And the life of the media, I mean, I'd hope it didn't sound like a sort of conspiracy that I was suggesting, although it is, you know, I've become, again, myself, a sort of assiduous reader of the Daily Mail lately in a way that I hadn't really done, you know, since the late 70s, you know, when it played a similar kind of role, it seems to me. One of the interesting, this goes back to the question that was asked about gender earlier on, one of the questions about the way that these media discourses operate is that they are very, very strongly gendered in character, and the male is a sort of limit case of all of that. So it seems to me that if the sound of the distinction between wisdom and ignorance sounded colonial to you, it sounded like an instance of colonial thinking. I'm sorry, I wasn't intending to lapse into Manichaeism there. And there are a range of other categories that can be brought to bear on this that don't conform to that logic. With regard to what survives in plural identity, I mean, you know, I suppose I don't think the answer is to respond to the situation of this melancholic relationship with the Second World War with a picture of you know, a Caribbean Spitfire pilot. You know, my I know that I have those pictures. I kind of collect them. They're interesting to me. My uncle was a bomber pilot, actually, and you know, got that kind of job because he could speak French and German and could therefore understand what was being said on the radio by the German pilots who were chasing, trying to shoot the bomber down. So I'm not asking for a sort of rescuing critique on multiculturalist discourse that allows a sort of the plural nation to take its shape through finding that person, those men and women from the empire who gave their lives in the struggle against Nazism. I mean, I put that image on the front of the original version of Ain't No Black in the Union Jack of a black serviceman at the Senator precisely because I felt it was the end of that kind of conversation. I'm really trying to suggest something more radical than that, which is that the obsession with the war is not something which is amenable to kind of multicultural correction, and that we need to think differently about ourselves and our future. We need to think with reference to a future in ways that would loosen the hold of that particular mythography on us. Are there particular things that survive? I don't know. I mean, you know, I'm interested in, you know, what about gardening? Gardening might survive, perhaps, or you know, the right to roam, jury trials. I mean, the sound of, you know, bird song in the early morning. I don't know. I mean, there's lots of things that would survive. The issue is not that we have to be free of all of that, but that we don't make it serve those other ends I've been trying to criticize.
I shall clearly need to look more closely than I have done hitherto at the newspaper bill in the sociology department, because this notion that we are consuming large numbers of daily mails is one that rather alarms me. Before I close, I should say that Professor Rose, of head of the sociology department, invites LSE staff and students, I'm afraid not everybody for reasons of space, for a drink up on the fifth floor, so you're welcome to join Nick and Paul for that. But I ought to end by thanking Paul. One thing that I've noticed since I came here is that the tradition of the inaugural lecture for new professors has fallen somewhat into disuse. And when I suggested that we might revive this a bit, people said, oh, no one will be interested. Well, that wasn't the case this evening. A huge turnout, and it was great. Thank you.